We're very glad that we can be here with you during these days and to look together at one of the wonderful books in the Bible. One of the themes of this book is how we're saved by grace and not by law. And so as we begin this book, if you glance at the book, in fact, what I'm going to do is we obviously are not going to cover the first 8 chapters of this book in great detail, some places more detail than others. But you notice that when you open the book, that Paul talks about some of his work. He says he's a bondservant of Jesus Christ. That means he doesn't have rights of his own. He's under the direction of Jesus. He's called to be an apostle. An apostle is a sent out one. He's separated to the gospel. And so then he talks about this wonderful son, Jesus Christ, who was born of the seed of David according to the flesh. And verse 5, through him we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name. You see, it's not just something that you get in a little box and tie it with 10 strings and sign it and put it on the shelf. It's for obedience of faith among all nations. And so he says there in verse 7, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. You notice that it's always in that order. He never says peace to you and grace. You see, a lot of people would like to have peace first, and if grace comes along, that's all right. But God's way is pour out grace in your life, and that becomes the whole foundation for peace. And so what we have here is a wonderful presentation of what Paul has in mind. He's thanking God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. And just think about that. Their faith was spoken of throughout the whole world. It wasn't that they were famous for making quilts or famous for their wood products or famous for whatever you might want to name, but they were famous for their faith. And so he longs to see them, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift so that you may be established. In other words, he wants to impart something to them, but also that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith of both you and me. So you see, he was looking at this as the opportunity to meet one another and encourage each other in the faith. And he actually wanted to come a lot sooner, but he was hindered, and he's saying, I'd like to have fruit among you also. I'm a debtor to both Greeks and barbarians, both wise and unwise, and I'm hoping to preach in Rome. That brings us to verses 16 and 17, and it explains why Paul was so anxious to preach in Rome. You see, the first 4 there, he's saying, I am not ashamed. Now, in the ancient world, a message that sprang from a leader who had been crucified would be a very shameful situation. You know, when you think about it, there was a huge shame associated with that, being crucified. It was the worst possible death that could be handed out to a person. And what has happened? The gospel has transformed that instrument of shame, degradation, and torture into the symbol of the central part of Christianity. And so the gospel, that what it means is, it's good news. And it's such good news, it couldn't have been dreamed up. You know, if you look at some of the false religions of the world, they talk about how man is and he can get better and better by doing this and this and this and this and eventually get to some supposedly wonderful thing. And the Bible doesn't say that at all. It says the opposite. It says man is bad. He's a lot worse than you think. He's terrible. But God did something so that he could take terrible man, forgive his sins, then transform him so that he actually becomes a righteous person and can live with God forever and actually bring glory to God. That is truly amazing. And this is such good news. You see, when people were making up religions, people never make that one up. It's always, you can do it yourself, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then the second 4 tells why God, the second 4 tells why Paul is not ashamed. He says, for it is the power of God. In other words, it has the ability to accomplish something. And by the way, the Greek word there is dunamis. And people love to play tricks with Greek language. They play tricks in ways they would never do it in English, and they feel spiritual about it. They'll say, dunamis, oh yes, it's the dynamite of God. I'll guarantee you, Paul did not have that in mind. Dynamite was invented only within the last couple of centuries. And so he was figuring out what kind of word to use to describe his invention. And so it was decided to use the Greek word dunamis, and that's where we get the word dynamite. Dynamite is an explosive, destructive power, and Paul is not talking about explosive and destructive power at all. He's talking about the transformative power of the gospel. So don't play those kind of games. People love to do it, and it's not the right thing to do, and you get the wrong impression anyway. And so the gospel has power to take utterly wicked people, forgive them, and transform them into a good and gracious person. And you see, this power is the power of God. It's not just something that was gathered up from somewhere by some committee. He is the supreme one, and it's power of God to salvation. It's the supreme project. It's making unholy man holy, and it's for everyone. No exception. No requirements of rank or position or family or status. It's for everyone who believes, and that's the required condition. Everyone who believes. That clearly means that this is a conditional arrangement. And so the gospel is drawing all men to God. And then the next verse, verse 17, it begins also with the word for, and it explains how the gospel is the power of God. You see, for in it, in other words, how is the gospel the power of God? It is because in it the righteousness of God is revealed. Now, sometimes people look at the gospel and think, well, it isn't fair. I mean, God punished some person and then other people can go free. I mean, there's all kinds of complaints people make about God. But here it's saying, God's righteousness is revealed by the transforming power of the gospel. And notice, it is presently happening. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed. Now, how is it revealed? It's revealed as real righteousness is lived out at higher and higher levels by the believer. See, the gospel has a transformative power, but the world doesn't see God's righteousness. But if it transforms your life and you live that out, and then you grow in faith, and then you live that out, and you grow in faith and live that out, then that is revealing the gospel to the world around us. And so, it says, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. In other words, this is accomplished through faith. Now, that brings us to verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Now notice here, God's wrath is presently being revealed by the actions of ungodly men. And that is what we're going to be looking at in verses 18 to 32. Now, do you notice verse 16 and 17? The gospel is powerful, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. In other words, as godly people live out the gospel through the power of God, it is an unveiling of God's righteousness, and it's a demonstration of God's righteousness on the earth. In a contrasting way, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. In other words, God's wrath is presently being revealed. We tend to think that God's wrath will be revealed in the future. Well, it's true that God's wrath will be poured out in the future, and there will be a revelation of that. But this is talking about how God's wrath is being revealed now. Now, it shows in verses 18 to 23 that humanity is worthy of wrath. And what is the big area of guilt? Verse 18, there is a summary statement. Something is being revealed. Something is happening right now. This is not talking about a future judgment. This is the wrath of God. It's a severe divine displeasure, and it's from heaven. In other words, this is a sovereign act of judgment that proceeds from God's throne. It's a present wrath which is pointing ultimately toward future wrath. It comes from the highest authority against human perversity. And notice it's against the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And I think there's two different words there. The ungodliness means basically religious failure, ungodliness. And that same idea could be suggested in Greek as well. And then unrighteousness is moral failure, wrongdoing or injustice or wickedness. The fact is, when you have religious failure, in other words, failure toward God, that will always result in injustice toward other human beings. Notice it says against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. It's comprehensive and there are no exceptions. And this applies to any person. It's an indictment against all of humanity. I used to, when I read this chapter, I thought, well, this chapter is talking about how the Gentiles are guilty, the pagans. And then chapter 2 is talking about how the Jews are guilty, the religious people. That's not what it says here. It doesn't say Gentile. It says men. It's revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Who is the object of this wrath? Verse 18b, it is the truth suppressors. Now, this can be illustrated by pagans, for example, Edom. If you read Ezekiel 25:14, and if you read Jonah 3:9, there are pagans that are against God. But there is wrath that is against God's people also in the Old Testament. For example, Moses made lots of excuses at the burning bush. And finally, the wrath of God was kindled against him. Balaam, who refused God's clear direction and asked again, God's wrath came upon him. Jehoshaphat, for making an alliance with Ahab, God's wrath came upon him. God's wrath against his people, various places it's found. And who is it against here? In other words, God's wrath is presently being revealed against truth suppressors, whether they're God's people or whether there are pagans. And it's presented against truth suppressors. How do they do that? They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Now, some translations say by unrighteousness. In other words, this is the means by which truth gets suppressed. Or other translations say in unrighteousness. In other words, they're completely comfortable in their wicked lifestyle. And both of those are true. Maybe Paul had both in mind. So truth is suppressed by evil lifestyle and by a perverted rationalization to make it sound like this evil lifestyle is okay. You find that happening over and over. Notice that when you read verses 18 and following, the suppression of the truth is the fountainhead of ungodliness and unrighteousness. Now, verse 19, what is known is made clear. Why is it clear? It's because God has made it clear. In other words, it is known because God has made it known. And that means, verse 20, that the people are absolutely inexcusable. It says here, his unseen attributes are clearly seen by means of the created things. In other words, they're clearly understood. In fact, when Paul preached, he appealed to God's revelation of himself. For example, Lystra in Acts 14 and Athens in Acts 17, he was talking about how God has revealed himself. So, how are God's attributes made clear just by creation? Let's think about this a little bit. The existence of the universe proves there had to be a powerful creator. Now, you see, our world doesn't want to believe that, because if you admit that there was somebody who designed this. He is very smart and very powerful and very dangerous. In fact, the famous evolutionist said, "We cannot allow a divine foot in the door." That's a quote from an evolutionist. They realized that if they would admit that there's a God in heaven who's created this earth with all of its complexity and beauty, and the universe with all of its amazing things, then we would be accountable to that person. And that is the fundamental rationale for wanting to believe the theory of evolution. And so it proves there's a powerful creator. Now you might say, well, okay, somebody made this universe, but then where'd God come from? Maybe somebody made God. You see how that would be a logical question to ask. But if you start going down that path, what do you have? You have, well, conceivably, there could be a bigger God that made God who created the world. Well, then, where'd that one come from? Well, conceivably, there could be even a greater God behind that one, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't go back forever. So what do you have to have? You have to have a God that has always existed. Because something can't arise out of nothing. And so, you see, even the creation is shouting, there had to be an eternal God that made this. He is a lawgiver. How do we know? Because people have an innate human sense of ethics. They believe that this is right and this is wrong. And somebody might say, well, I mean, after all, I believe that whatever's right for you and whatever's right for me might not be the same. We can decide. If somebody asks you that, a good question to say to him is, well, what if someone killed your daughter? Would that be all right? What kind of answer do you think you'll get? Oh, no, that wouldn't be all right. You see, because when it hits them, it's like, no, this isn't just. You see, there is something inside every human being that says there's some things that are right and some things that are wrong. Now, this can get all twisted around. But that is evidence that there is a lawgiver somewhere. You know, grizzly bears have no sense of right and wrong. What about his deity, his majesty? It's just amazing. You know, we had a display of God's special majestic glory in the heavens recently, didn't we? This eclipse of the sun. That is truly a glorious thing. And just think, those kind of events have been happening with precision down through the years. You know, when you, Rhoda and I had the privilege of being at a spot where the total eclipse was. And when you have totality, all of a sudden you can see the solar atmosphere of the sun, where the corona, where those that brightness is going out from the sun. Ordinarily you can't see it because the sun is so bright it obscures the thing. See, there are things like that that you cannot see except at special times. In other words, it's doing it all the time, but you can't see it. Or there are things in the universe that you cannot even know about until you have special instruments to measure them. For example, there are rocks that look very plain and ordinary, and then if you shine ultraviolet light on them, oh, amazing colors, red and blue and green and orange, depending on what kind of minerals are in those rocks. Guess what? Humanity went for thousands of years without ever knowing that until men developed things with ultraviolet light that could shine on those things and learn how to make that happen. And that beauty was there the whole time. You know, the more you look at the universe, the more you see God's majesty and glory. Thus, verse 20, error is absolutely inexcusable. They have no legal defense. But what happens? Not only have they forsaken truth, they embrace folly. And you know, when you forsake truth, you will always embrace folly. Why? Because to forsake truth you start wanting to feel comfortable about that, and so you're looking for ways to convince yourself that you are legitimate in forsaking the truth. In other words, what you've forsaken isn't really true, and what you're newly embracing is. So you're looking for ways to prove that the new thing is true and the old thing was false. And guess what? You will likely find what you're looking for, and you will embrace what is false and believe that it's true, and reject what was true and is true and believe that it's false. Now, what did they do? Verse 21 and 22, they knew God, and they didn't glorify or thank him as he deserved. Notice, the primary root sin is not violating God's laws, but it's failure to glorify God and to give thanks. Oh, I think we don't contemplate that enough, don't you? How many times have I failed to glorify God? How many times have I failed to give thanks? In fact, they thought wrong thoughts. It says, futile in their reasonings. Literally, it would be worthless in their reasoning. They lose the ability to reason from the universe to God and to think accurately about him. And so these reasonings originate in a corrupted heart and lead to more corruption of the heart, as is shown by the following phrase. Notice it says, their foolish heart is darkened. That means the entire inner life is darkened. And that is the inevitable result of those who turn away from God, who is light. If you turn away from God, where the light is, you're heading into the dark. And so your foolish heart will be darkened, guaranteed. And then what happens? The person thinks they are very wise while embracing folly. Oh, they feel so wise. Look at this. And by the way, this happens to any person, not just the pagans. And so they embrace an utterly corrupted concept of God. You see, God's actual character is a character of glory, and it's incorruptible. It cannot be tarnished or perverted. But now man, instead of glorifying God as God and giving thanks, he falsely portrays God by something that's a mere image. And so you see, you're moving from the true God and the glory of God to a progressive perversion of the concept of God that you see in pagan deities, for example. And it says the image of the likeness of. In other words, it's a step removed from reality. And notice, it is not only that, but he liked more and more degraded things. From God to an image of the likeness of what? Corruptible man. That's a huge step down. And then birds can fly, but that's still a step down from man. And then four-footed animals can't even get off the ground for any significant distance. And then reptiles, creeping things. I mean, it's once you start down that path, it's amazing the degradation that you soon embrace. And notice the horror of exchanging the glory of the incorruptible God for idolatry. Now, this is not limited just to pagans in Africa, but it's a special temptation to church people. Church people again and again turn away from what God says to promote their own ideas. I was sitting in a church service in a conservative Anabaptist church one time, and the speaker said, "Let's skip the theology and get to the practical stuff." Bad statement. Because it's only when you have the theology right that you can really do the practical stuff correctly. You know, in the eternal scheme, theology is the most practical of all subjects. Why? Because we must align ourselves with who God is, what his purposes are, and understand our whole experience in light of him. And if we don't do that, we'll be missing out tremendously. Have you ever heard this quote? Some people are so heavenly minded, they're of no earthly good. That's a popular quote. Do you know unbelievers never use that quote? They don't give a rip. It's only professing believers that talk about that. The fact is, it's only the people who are truly heavenly minded that will be of any ultimate earthly good. Because we have to be drawing nearer to God ourselves and helping other people draw near to God. That is the important thing in life. Nothing else matters in comparison. You see, believing that God's Word and God's Spirit are not sufficient for holiness, that's the temptation that church people have. They don't believe that God's Word is sufficient, God's Spirit is sufficient to have holiness. We've got to devise some method of our own instead of God's method. You see, that's turning away from God. It is not glorifying God as God. It's not being thankful for God's provision. And the result is an idolatry of pitiful man-made structures that they create as a substitute for God. You know, men prefer self-made religion instead of God's revelation. You think about it. It's like, why did the Israelites want a golden calf? Something that they could touch, something they could see. They were willing to take something that was false and tangible instead of reaching out to what was true and intangible. But you see, that temptation is with us today as well. It's so much easier to create something that is tangible and say, yes, we'll latch onto that. That'll work. Instead of saying, it is only the power of God by which we stand. It is by faith in Him. It is by His methods that He has devised, not by things that we've dreamed up. And so what happens? Many people in churches trade God's glory for a mere image. Instead of having the untouchable glory of resurrection life, they change it for an outer form that they can guarantee. Give us something that will guarantee holiness on our terms, instead of saying, give us resurrection life that will give us holiness on your terms. Those are vastly different things. Let us say like the psalmist, Psalm 26, verse 8, Lord, I have loved the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. Now, I want to show you a little chiasm. I know you've heard about that before. Verse 18, they suppress the truth. Then go down to verse 23, they exchange God's glory for idols. That's one inclusio. Come down from the top. Verse 19, God has clearly shown them. Verse 21a, up from the bottom, they knew God. And the focus is verse 20. They are inexcusable. You see, this is the very point that people often wonder about. What about the heathen who have never heard the gospel? And the answer is, God has sufficiently revealed Himself in creation that they are without excuse. Now, in verses 20 to 23, you have him moving on what man does as he rejects God. And then there's a transition, verse 24, what God does to those who reject Him. Verse 24 to 32, there's the outpouring of God's wrath. Now, how is God's wrath currently, presently, being revealed? Is it being revealed by dramatic, catastrophic judgments? Does God strike people down with thunderbolts or heart attacks or direct judgments like the Assyrian army, 185,000 soldiers died in one night? You know, you can say, well, sure, there are certain occasions where a certain person is struck by lightning, somebody has a heart attack. But in the general pattern of things, God is not doing that with all the people who are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. How is God having His wrath presently being revealed from heaven against all this ungodliness? It is by God helping men who suppress the truth, helping them pursue their wickedness. And this applies to all men, not just pagans. In fact, it's important to notice similar terminology in the Psalms so that it gets clear. Turn to Psalm 81, verse 11 and 12. The psalmist says he wanted Israel to follow him. In verse 11, he says, "But my people would not hear my voice, and Israel would have none of me. So I gave them over to their own stubborn heart to walk in their own counsels." Now, God is telling that about his people. He's not talking about the pagans there. You see, God will help you pursue your own wickedness if you decide to indulge in it. And this corresponds to God's hardening of Pharaoh. In fact, the frequent Hebrew word that's used, you can look at Exodus 4:21, means to make strong. In other words, it's not so much a judicial hardening, God just decides to harden somebody, but rather a feeling of strongness in what they are doing. You see, God opens the door for you to pursue more of what you corruptly want to do if that's your choice. In fact, this answers one of the puzzles that I had in my life. In the winter of 2010, the Lord opened my understanding of this passage. I had been puzzled for 30 years. How could men in the church, even leaders, lie or crush people underfoot? Why was there no repentance? And if you've lived long enough, you know of situations where that kind of thing has happened. How can that be? Why doesn't God convict them? Why isn't he doing anything about that? That bothered me a lot. But this passage gives the answer. It is God's wrath being revealed. You see, God's wrath is revealed against all men who suppress the truth in ungodliness and unrighteousness. And so, he actually opens the door in allowing men to pursue more fully their follies. In fact, the higher a man's position, the greater is his opportunity to either pursue folly or to point men to God alone. In fact, often the way this works, God sets before all men an open door of opportunity which displays existing character and intensifies it. The good man displays his goodness, and the bad man displays his perversity. And this revelation of the wrath of God right now, is only obvious to those who are spiritual, who understand what he's saying here in Romans. You see, the unspiritual views this as God is lenient. That's God's mercy or his grace. Well, there is mercy in not cutting him off right away. But actually, God's wrath is what is presently being revealed when you see a person taking more and more steps into ungodliness. I've had discussions with an individual who's a great writer, and this person wrote this, quote, "For a while, I thought that power, like other intensifying circumstances, such as pain or prosperity, simply revealed a person's true character. But that hypothesis didn't account for the fact that sometimes a person's character seems to change. That after being in power a while, they begin to act in ways that they themselves would have considered unthinkable years earlier. So this is what I think now. Power opens up doors of possibility previously inaccessible. Some open into rooms of righteous deeds, and some open into rooms of accomplishing very good things for very good reasons by brief suspension of one aspect of righteousness. A person's character determines which door he chooses. Once inside one of these questionable rooms, however, one finds doors opening into bigger and better rooms, involving some other slightly more involved suspensions of righteousness, to be sure. And unless a person repents and backtracks very fast, he can end up deep in a maze of shocking ungodliness. So yes, power can appear to corrupt because it expands possibilities. You get power, you can go through worse doors than you could before if you want to. And most people want to. I think that abuse of power is a major reason why wives often resent husbands, children often resent parents, the population resents the politicians, and the laity resents church leaders. Authority is not given so that you can make other people do what you want. But all of us want other people to do what we want. And once we are in a position where we can make it happen, why not? Parents are given authority in order to train their children for the Lord, but a parent curtails his 6-year-old's retelling of a story not because of any training in godliness motive, but because adults don't enjoy repetition like children do, and he's already heard the story 5 times. Husbands are given authority in order to facilitate their wives becoming glorious in sanctification. But a husband tells his wife she has to paint the hall green instead of lavender, not because he thinks lavender paint would hinder her sanctification, but because he thinks green would look better, and it's easier just to impose his will than to come to an agreement together. Politicians are given authority in order to punish the evil and praise the righteous, but they regulate sales of raw milk, make midwifery illegal, and write complicated codes about how many wall ties you have to mortar into a brick veneer, or send a man to the galleys for failing to remove his hat as the king passed by. Church leaders are given authority to protect the flock, in order to lead and protect the flock of Christ. But they require the wearing of black socks or prohibit the consumption of alcohol or tell a member what ministry they may or may not be involved in or prevent a parent from taking a child to the hospital. It's all manifestations of the same thing, using one's position to legislate matters unrelated to the job description as laid out in the Bible. It doesn't excuse resentment and bitterness on the part of subordinate or exempt him from obedience unless God's laws have a counterclaim. But God's view of such authorities and his intentions toward them, as explained in the prophets, is enough to make anyone tingle down to his gallbladder. End of quote. You see, it is so easy to walk through a door where you know you can do it and suppress some aspect of truth in order to accomplish a very good thing. But when you do that, you are embracing disaster. And it's a case of God's wrath being revealed. Now notice, this text that we're looking at, Romans chapter 1, the moral corruption is the result of God's wrath, not the reason for God's wrath. This chapter is not talking about so much that, well, people were doing a whole bunch of bad stuff, and therefore God's wrath is revealed. But it's God's wrath is being revealed as he opens the door for them to do worse and worse things. And that will be true of all men, whether they're believers or not. Now, in saying that, there is also God's Spirit working, convicting. You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have done that. But when you walk through one of those doors and you experience the good results that you were looking for, it's very easy to shut that voice up. And before long, you don't hear it very much. Now, an illustration of this is God's action regarding Cain. Isn't it interesting that God put a mark on him to keep him from getting killed when he was a murderer? But what did he do? He established a civilization apart from God. He says he went out from the presence of the Lord and built a city. You see, and that city and those descendants were a progression into worse and worse things. You see, God's wrath, both present and future, is a withdrawal of himself. I believe that one of the things we need to really think about, the most important thing, is to draw nearer to God. And God said, if you draw near to me, I will what? Draw near to you. But if you draw away from me, what does he do? He accepts what you say. And you see this happening right here in this passage. And so, this wrath is presently being revealed. And notice verse 24 to 32 is a unit, and it's emphasized by the threefold use of the word give over or give up. Verse 24, you have it. Therefore, God also gave them up to something. He handed them over. It's the same word that's used where Judas betrayed Jesus. And so the focus of this section is the moral deterioration that is actually initiated and precipitated by a false concept of God. They did not glorify God, neither were thankful. You see, that is really the root issue here. And if you don't glorify God and aren't thankful for his wonderful provision in Christ, then you are wide open for what follows. God gives them over to worse and worse things. Now, verse 24, therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Who was it that he gave over to this? It was those who exchanged the glory of God for idolatry, verses 21 to 23. Now, you see, in the human side, the desires were already in their hearts, but with the restraint removed, then there's even greater opportunity to pursue them greedily, like it says in Ephesians 4. Pursue uncleanness greedily. Now, that can be reformatory in purpose, in the sense that maybe someone gets into gross enough sin and they suddenly realize, terrible, what have I gotten into? And then they repent. But most of the time, it usually doesn't work that way. They just move to a new level of degradation. One example where this evil was actually reformatory was in the life of Bill Murray O'Hare. Bill Murray O'Hare was the son of Madeline Murray O'Hare, and she taught her son to live wickedly and to not believe in God. But you can imagine, as he pursued that kind of lifestyle, his life began to fall apart in all kinds of ways, and that got him to thinking, and he actually changed his mind and became a Christian. That shows God's amazing mercy in this process. But you see, God turned him over to worse and worse things. But then, in the process, he finally came to his senses. But the usual case is a continuation in those things. Now notice, idolatry and sexual sin are connected. Sexual sin results when there is a failure to worship God. You see, this is connecting verses 23 and 24, the therefore, you know, for the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And then that's verse 18 down for. And then therefore, God gave them up. Therefore what? His wrath is being revealed against all these who don't honor him as God. And it's interesting that pagan religions regard fornication as an act of worship. It's all part of the whole deal. And so they provided prostitutes to serve in the temple. So you see, here you have the source is the lust of their own heart. It begins in the heart. It results in physical debasement. And they become the active agents of their own self-destruction. In other words, those who dishonor God are appropriately judged by making them the very agents of their own destruction in the dishonoring of their bodies. And what happens? They exchange the truth of God for the lie, verse 25, and they magnify the creature above the creator. They worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. You know, we have an illustration of that in America, in the United States. I mean, there was a time at least that the bald eagle was a protected bird, and they were rare in the wild, or reasonably rare. And I'm sure you could have gotten in much more trouble in the U.S. in those days if you had killed a baby bald eagle than if you'd aborted your own baby. You see, that just illustrates how twisted things become. And similarly, think about 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 11 and 12. It says, God will send great delusion to who? Those who did not receive the love of the truth. It is so important to love the truth, because if you don't really love the truth, see, it's not enough just to do some truth, but if you don't really receive the love of the truth, you are wide open for deception. And it says there God will send great delusion for such people so that they can actually be condemned. So what happens is when you magnify the creature above the creator, according to verse 25, you value what is temporary more than what is blessed forever. And one of the essential aspects of idolatry is to place something of creation in God's place. And these actions actually reveal the wrath of God, verse 25. So you see, when you see these kind of things happening, you can say to yourself, oh, I don't have to be frustrated by what's going on. This is God's wrath being presently revealed. That brings us down to the next part, verse 26 and 27. And there's another thing that God gave them up to. What is it? Those who exchange the truth of God for the lie. Those are the ones that he's giving this up to. And The one true God must be worshipped as God. You see, human unrighteousness is fundamentally a refusal to worship God and submit to his authority. So now God gives them up to a whole new level. Oh, you liked uncleanness? Okay, you can have something even more. That is, you can have vile passions, perversions, instead of natural sexual relationships. What we see in America with homosexuality, described right here, is God giving people up to worse and worse things. And by the way, I wish they had translated this literally. Practically all the versions don't translate it literally. It doesn't use the term in here in 26 and 27, men and women. It does not use that term. It says males and females. In other words, it's emphasizing the sexual character, the sexual characteristic of these two classes of humanity, named the male class and the female class. It doesn't even call them men and women. In other words, it's emphasizing their degradation and their focus on sexuality. And so, the passions are described as vile. They exchange the natural use for the unnatural. Notice it's a bad exchange again. You had these bad exchanges. They changed, you know, the glory of God for these idols. And now they change the natural use for that which is against nature. And interestingly enough, this evil is led even by the females. Notice it says first, even their women exchange the natural, or even their females, I should say, even their females exchange the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men leaving the natural use of the, or the males leaving the natural use of the female, burned in their lust for one another, males with males committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. You see, they receive a penalty in themselves, and this physical penalty is the outcome of being given over in judgment to wrong thinking. And by the way, when it says that penalty for the error which was their due, that's really hardly strong enough just to say error. I think the word perversion would be better. And so it's a stronger idea. Well, do you enjoy perversion? Do you like that? Well then, God says, I'll give you something else. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And then it lists a whole list of things. Who is this that get the debased mind? It's those who want to forget God. They don't want to retain God in their knowledge. They did not approve to have God in their knowledge, and so they get to the point they don't even want to have any knowledge of God. They don't want to remember anything about him. They don't want to remember that he's a God of holiness and justice. And so God acts with a characteristic response. He gives them over to a depraved mind. You see, they didn't want to have God in their knowledge, and God gave them over to a disapproved mind. In other words, God gives them over to a mind that's not working properly. You see, they don't want to think properly about the universe. Okay, then you can think improperly about it. And it's amazing how when you encounter people that have been rejecting truth and you try to reason with them, they become so unreasonable. It's very difficult. So God gives them over to a mind that isn't able to make correct moral judgments. And so all of a sudden they think this is a great moral issue, but they'll embrace this other thing that is truly an immoral issue. You see, rejection of God will result in an explosion of horrible sins. And it lists these things that happen. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. Oh, what a list. How did this all begin? Did not glorify God as God, neither were thankful. And then eventually get to the point where they don't even want to retain God in their knowledge. And so you're cut loose from all of the goodness of God, the wisdom of God, the ethics of God, and that shoves you into a thing where you just are unleashing all kinds of wickedness. And you see, this perversion greedily pursues wickedness and corruption. If you reject something that God has said, it makes it impossible for you to think correctly about that issue. If you turn away from the light of revelation, that disqualifies you to think correctly about the issues of life. God's will and His ways are important, crucial for understanding the world in which we live. And so the result is that there is a perverted treatment of other human beings that you see in this list. You see, rejecting truth brings unimaginable folly. You remember in the Old Testament where it talked about there's going to come judgment and it'll be so severe that in the siege, a woman who's known for her tenderness and her gentleness, she hardly wants to put her foot on the ground. She's so gentle. She will eat her own baby in the siege. In other words, she gets to a point where she would do the thing that would be totally unthinkable to her. When you go down this path of rejecting truth, and God says, okay, you want more of that? You have no idea where you're going to stop. You see, it begins by not wanting to glorify God. And then it ends with not wanting to retain a knowledge of God. In other words, God, get out of their life, is what they're saying. And it ends up with total viciousness and perversion, filled with all unrighteousness, verse 29. It's not half-hearted. And notice verse 32. They pursue this in the face of God's judgment. They knew God's judgment is righteous. Now, that's quite interesting. Evidently, they knew the pagans in this crowd would have known God's judgment from general revelation, from the universe. They wouldn't have heard the gospel, per se. Or if it's people that have heard the gospel, they know God's judgment from the Bible. But even though they know it's righteous, they still do these things. They know such practice deserves death. Now, what does that mean? Most of the things that are listed here in a human court would not be things that would be counted worthy of death. I mean, for example, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit. Most courts would not say those things are worthy of death. So when it says they know this is worthy of death, it must be an awareness that such things end up with a punishment in hell. But even so, they practice evil and approve those who practice evil. You see, if you condone or applaud evil, that contributes to an evil environment that helps other people more easily do evil. And by the way, that shows the seriousness of condoning or passively condoning even evil that others commit because of the good you get out of the system. You know, there were people in Germany who knew Hitler was doing bad things. But their attitude was, well, yes, I know he's doing these bad things, but he's sure done Germany a lot of good. See? Condoning evil. So what do we conclude from this? The righteousness of God is presently being revealed. How? As His people walk by faith and exhibit by their lifestyle God's righteousness as it's worked out with His power to higher and higher levels. And so the world can see what God's righteousness is really like. But God's wrath is also being presently revealed, and that's the focus of a bigger section in this chapter. His wrath is presently being revealed by those who don't glorify God as God, which means receiving Him as supreme, His word is the answer, and are not thankful. And very quickly, God opens doors in front of them to have things that may even be good, but require a suspension of righteousness. And quickly, it gets worse and worse. You see, God's wrath is actually a withdrawal of Himself. And it's actually a giving people over to the very things that they like to do and feel good about doing things that they once knew were departures from what God said. for tomorrow, we're going to try to give a survey of chapter 2, 3, and 4. I know that's a big chunk of material, but so study for tomorrow chapter 2, 3, and 4, and we'll try to survey that in terms of what God has to say as we go through the book of Romans.